It's 21 to go till 5, your downtown program here on the Pulse, AM 620, WZON, and the WZON app. Rich Kimble, Brian Stackpole, and Bruce Pratt here with you at Seasons Main Street in Bangor, our Quality Jewelers broadcast studio downtown, presented by Hollywood Casino, Hotel, and Raceway at 500 Main Street. Sports Lit 101, Bruce here with us this week, and we've talked about this book a little bit. Very interesting book, and one that ought to be of particular interest to folks in Maine with the whole subject and debate going on about a potential second national park in Maine.
Yeah, Sue Eisenfeld, it's a very interesting book because she has long been a hiker. She and her husband spent all of their time in the Shenandoah National Forest. And she, when she learned the story of how the National Forest came about, she wasn't quite as happy with the fact that it's there. I mean, I think she would come down on the side of it in the long run. This was the best thing for the most people. So what I thought I'd do this week, since she's going to be on with us next week, is talk about what is different about Shenandoah and what is proposed here in Maine so that no one thinks that we're coming down on one side or the other. We're trying to be objective here. The Shenandoah National Park was done by eminent domain and the threat of eminent domain. The state of Virginia took the land. Acadia and Yellowstone were gifts from philanthropists. That's what they're talking about in the Millinocket in the Katahdin region. In that way, it's different. Shenandoah was, in a sense, preserved because of its proximity to Washington and Baltimore, that there was a great fear that those mountains would be changed drastically because they were so close to so much money. Last time I looked, I have a camp up that way. There is no huge population center nearby. But the most important thing is Shenandoah came about through the lobbying of politicians. Politicians of Virginia, like the Byrd family, the traditional oligarchical and patriarchal political families, were afraid that smokestack industries would become the main thrust of the Virginia economy. They didn't want that. They believed that tourism and a special kind of tourism could provide a lot of money. So the impetus didn't come from a private person as it did with Acadia and it would be the case here in Maine now. But it came from politicians pushing hard to get this. However, they struck a really different kind of deal, and this is where this gets dicey. The state of Virginia condemned the land and then gave it to the federal government, who then created a national park. And, on the one hand, if this were uninhabited land, that would be one thing. But there had been many families there for generations, successful people, and the smear campaign launched against them. I mean, it sounds like all the sort of old British propaganda about the Irish famine, that they starved because they were lazy. They starved because they had too many children. They starved because they were drunkards. I mean, none of those things were true, but it's easier to starve people if you say that those people aren't worth something. So there was a major campaign. A guy named William Carson was somewhat to blame for this, to get that change. In the Katahdin region, there are not that many people living year-round in these areas. Now, there are seasonal camps. The situation in Shenandoah was that many people had leases on land, but they were private. Person leased the land to someone else. We have in the past had the paper companies and the timber companies do it. The Quimbys do own, and her LLC does own, a tremendous amount of land in which there are seasonal camps. Those would go if there were a national park, as far as I can tell, that a national park is not going to let people continue to have seasonal personal camps there. They did a little bit in Shenandoah, let some of the people hang on longer. They did allow people, they do still allow people to tend family graveyards and cemeteries and to take care of them. So it's a different, it's not totally analogous. However, one must remember this. What keeps getting lost in the debate in Maine, and I want to talk to Sue about this, is I don't have any indication, nor have I heard anyone convincingly make the case that the federal government wants a second national park. You look at Acadia, my friend Christian Barter, who's one of, I think, America's finest young poets who works on the trail crew there. I talked to him about the season they didn't open for the whole time. He didn't have enough money. I cannot imagine in this day and age where we keep hearing government's too big, government's too big, government's too big, that a new national park is on the radar of anybody in Washington. And because we do not have all four of our congressional officers beating the drum for it, I find it less likely to be an issue. And Virginia has millions more people than Maine and did then, so that the number of people pushing for something or pushing against it was a bigger deal then. And that's one of the things that I want to talk to Sue about, is how that park came about, what the pressures were that brought it, and the like.
Well, we had Sean Faircloth from the Bangor City Council on the show a few weeks back talking about it, and Sean was pretty upfront about the fact that his support for this is based on one thing, jobs.
Yeah.
Jobs, and what it might do not only for that region, but in a spinoff for the Bangor area as well. The Bangor City Council has come out in support of this. The opposition tends to focus on the potential limits to recreational use, especially the snowmobilers, the trail system, the ITS that goes through there could be in jeopardy. And then perhaps existing businesses and even potential businesses that might be limited by the natural restrictions that come when you have a national park.
Right. And I think in Maine, because firearms is always a huge debate, national parks have very strict laws about hunting and about carrying firearms. I think one of the things that is so difficult is, if you look at the Shenandoah Valley, if you've driven down through the Shenandoahs, I mean, they are among the most beautiful mountains in
absolutely.
America. It's an absolutely stunning country. And I always enjoy when I drive through them. But if you look at the cities from Harrisonburg down to Roanoke, it doesn't seem to me that it's the national park which has created, they have colleges and they have businesses and the like. So it's hard for me to understand just how much tourism has contributed to the Virginia economy vis-a-vis making this park. I do know, because I have more experience with the Smoky Mountain National Park, which was envisioned and created at about the same time, and is, like Acadia, one of the very most visited national parks, that there are businesses on the edges of that park that clearly exist because the park is there, whitewater rafting companies and outfitters and the like. But the number of jobs and how many of them are year-round would be, for me, the big question. Because if you don't have winter recreation in this area, if you're not going to have cross-country skiing and snowmobiling and snowshoeing and maybe backcountry skiing, ice fishing ain't going to cover it alone. So it'll be interesting to talk to Sue Eisenfeld, especially because she's a city girl. I mean, she didn't grow up doing this.
Right.
And she would be the first to admit that she's sort of a vegan tree hugger, loved the park, would love to see the whole world be a national park. But yet she had some really, really deep concerns about the way national parks both operate and are brought into existence. So the book is called Shenandoah, A Story of Conservation and Betrayal. It's published by our friends at the University of Nebraska Press, who's got their new list out, and we haven't finished going through their old list of stuff. We should be getting new books from them and from Marquette. She's a very good writer, a very skilled writer. And the great thing about this book is it's only about 165 pages long. There's not a lot of wasted time, but she really makes you feel like you're in that park when she talks and writes about it. It's a very, 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 very interesting book, and I just happened to stumble on it, so I'm glad we found it.
Shenandoah, A Story of Conservation and Betrayal. Sue Eisenfeld wrote it, and she will join us next week on Sportslit 101 to talk more about it and talk about what's similar to the situation, the potential situation in Maine, and what's different as well.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think I've outlined what's mostly not analogous, and we'll let her really go on there because she's the expert, not me.
All right, we'll see that next week and talk with Sue. Thank you, Bruce.
Oh, my pleasure, Rich.
13 to go till the top of the hour. It's downtown.